All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention to the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to proceed with oral argument in these cases. Much as I regret the delay, this is obviously a situation in which an ounce of prevention is well worthwhile. So our first case is ready to go, the Bridgestone-Firestone multi-district litigation. Mr. Beisner.
May it please the court, I'm John Beisner, counsel for Appellant Ford Motor Company. When the Firestone tire controversy erupted almost 3 years ago, it sparked an enormous volume of litigation. In particular, it prompted the filing of almost 100 purported class actions, basically asserting the same claims based on the same allegations on behalf of the same proposed classes. Some of those cases were initially filed in federal court, some were filed in state court and removed there. And the judicial panel on multi-district litigation had what I believe was its first emergency session to deal with this onslaught of cases and decided to transfer all of them to a single federal court for the specific purpose of, and I'm quoting the order, presenting inconsistent rulings, particularly with respect to overlapping class certification requests. Once all of the cases were gathered in Indianapolis, the various class counsel prepared and filed a master complaint that supplanted all of the distinct complaints filed in that proceeding. And as sort of a price of admission, the class counsel all agreed to abandon their involvement in any competing state court class actions they had filed.
What was the precise terms of that undertaking? The language does not appear in your brief.
The precise terms, Your Honor, was there was a question from Judge Barker at a meeting asking them to whether they would be involved in state court litigation. And I believe, Your Honor, I will get you the page. I thought we had quoted in the introductory part of our opening brief the precise quote of counsel, chief counsel, lead counsel Don Barrett's response to that, which was, "We will only litigate before this court," I believe was the essence of his statement.
If you could provide us, perhaps, on your rebuttal argument with the precise language and a record reference, I'd appreciate it.
I will do so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
After considerable briefing and discovery, the trial court certified a nationwide class, but on a review under Rule 23F, this court reversed, holding that in multiple respects, it would be an abuse of discretion for a court to give these claims class treatment, whether asserted on a nationwide or single state basis. En banc review was denied, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari. At that critical juncture, an amnesia epidemic broke out, apparently forgetting that a final class certification determination had been made in the MDL proceeding, and further forgetting their commitments to litigate exclusively before the MDL court. Class counsel in the MDL proceeding began filing new, virtually identical class actions in state courts across the country. Other counsel reactivated cases that had been previously filed. And the district court has contributed to the state court stampede by remanding to state court a number of constituent class actions in the MDL proceeding, even though they had been subsumed into a master complaint that specifically pleaded federal question jurisdiction. The end result is that there are now 17 class actions pending in state courts, all competing to certify classes.
Have any of those 17 been certified as nationwide class actions?
Yes, Your Honor. There are several of them. I'll take that back, Your Honor. Several of them have been certified as single state class actions. I don't believe there's been a nationwide class action certified as of yet.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
In any event, all of those cases, there's competition to certify classes that this court has has determined would be improper and paving the way to trials that this court has concluded would fundamentally deny due process rights. Class certifications are being pursued vigorously in several of these cases, and I would note, Your Honor, in response to your question, there are motions for nationwide classes pending in several of those cases now and are imminent. The court's resolution of the class certification issues in this matter and the MDL proceeding that produced the record that formed a basis for that ruling should mean something. Its conclusion should not be subject to being overruled by whim by any state court that may wish to do so. And the class counsel in the MDL proceeding should not be able to take what they unapologetically say is an effort to evade this court's class certification ruling. They have bluntly told the district court in writing that their intent is to simply move the class claims to jurisdictions where, and I quote one of their filings, the Seventh Circuit's apparent philosophical antipathy to the economies and efficiencies of the class action mechanism do not control. For that reason, Ford and Firestone moved the district court to enjoin the prosecution of these claims on a class basis in other forms. 8 days later, the district court, without waiting for response from class counsel, denied that motion. By this appeal, defendants are asking this court to reverse, to require issuance of the requested injunction against these state court proceedings that seek to nullify this court's class certification decision. Now, we're not asking this court to establish a broad precedent declaring sacrosanct any and all federal court class certification rulings. In rejecting class certification rulings, appellate courts often find faults with aspects of class certification rulings and suggest to district courts that there may be ways to repair such rulings. And trial courts, in denying class certification motions, are very explicit in saying this is out without prejudice to the plaintiffs coming forward with a new proposal. Such class certification rulings, which I suggest to the court are probably more than norm, do lack finality. And we readily acknowledge that such rulings are probably not subject to All Writs Act protection. In this case, however, the court reached the broad conclusion that the claims in this case were simply too diverse factually to allow class treatment. And in particular, the court concluded that the geographic scope of the classes didn't really matter, whether the proposed class was nationwide in scope or simply confined to the residents of one state. The factual...
Counsel, let me tell you what my problem is with the breadth of your argument. One of the big problems with a nationwide class certified by a federal district court is that that district court couldn't apply any genuine state law. Federal judges serving as a ventriloquist dummy, you know, trying to figure out the vagaries of state law is very hard. On the other hand, a statewide class certified in state court is going to get you genuine state law, whatever the law is of that forum state. And I could understand an objection to New Jersey certifying a nationwide class, because then you're back in the bucket again. But New Jersey certifying a New Jersey class, you get real, genuine New Jersey law, including real, genuine New Jersey choice of law rules. Why is there any objection to that?
There are two issues here, Your Honor, and that one part of this court's ruling, as I understand it, was whether or not you were going to get genuine state law, as you suggested. But I think the other part of it was whether the defendant, and indeed to some extent the plaintiffs, were going to get due process. The court looked at the factual nature of these claims. Indeed, I think at one point saying they're virtually vehicle-specific, and held, in addition to the fact that the state law elements of this would be something that a federal court could not handle on a nationwide basis, further held that you couldn't do this on a single state basis,
we've said that. The only thing that was before us was the nationwide class. And it's certainly true that we warned the district judge off of sending it right back to us. But it's, you know, there's a difference between what an appellate court tries to warn a district judge off of, and what an appellate court has, as a matter of law, precluded any state court from doing. And I say, that's why I'm concerned about the breadth of your claim. If your argument were limited to trying to certify nationwide classes, I think you'd be on stronger ground.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court, as I understand it, its ruling, and it is this court's ruling, I acknowledge that, and obviously you are in the best position to interpret it.
Yeah.
But
authors don't get any privileged status.
But, Your Honor, I think that the crux of the ruling, we debated at length in the briefing the question whether there was factual predominance here. And the court made a finding that there was not factual predominance here. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing this on a state basis or a nationwide basis, because in each estate class, you would have the same jumble of claims, the same jumble of facts. It doesn't matter. And having made a determination in this case that it wasn't just the
estate judge wants to invest the remainder of his working life trying to unscramble a jumble, why is that something a federal court is entitled to prevent? It may not be sensible, right? Federal judge has to make a judgment about what's a sensible thing to do with the application of judicial time. But there's no federal rule that state courts have to be sensible as federal courts view good application of judicial time.
It seems, though, Your Honor, that there is a place where you have an MDL proceeding like this, where you've made this enormous investment of time, where you have reached findings about whether claims are susceptible to class treatment, that should be given some respect if that ruling has finality. And I believe that here the court did. I acknowledge in a lot of class actions rulings that would not be the case. But here the court reached some final conclusions that this case could not be managed as a group of claims on a class basis, whether it was being done nationwide or as a single state proceeding totally. And that finding should be given some respect. We should not have a system where the state court can effectively overrule that. In any case, a state court, no matter what rule they have, given the fact...
The state court certainly can't overrule the federal court. We know that. We know that the rules of preclusion being applied are federal. That's the holding of Semtec. It's actually kind of surprising that neither side discusses the Supreme Court's holding in Semtec. But anyway, the rules of preclusion are federal. We still need to figure out exactly what it is that would be precluded.
But I think, Your Honor, what is precluded here would be a state court finding that that the factual issues, the common factual issues, would predominate. This court made a finding to the contrary. And a state court certifying the class would have to overrule that.
Does that rest on a view that any state that uses the same language as Rule 23 has to give that language the same meaning that a federal court gives to Rule 23?
If you look at the rules that are out there, Your Honor, I mean, the court in this case went through the various elements of Rule 23 and basically gave this proposed class an F, a total failing grade in every key respect. Said the legal issues didn't predominate,
the
factual issues didn't predominate.
Firestone.
F as in failure. And there's no way a state court can work around those findings without overruling that determination of the court. That is not an area of discretion. And it's for that reason that we believe that the ruling of this court should be preclusive. Because the rules in the various states are largely derivative of Rule 23.
Yeah, but that's my question. If you write down in a state statute or a state procedural rule, same language as Federal Rule 23, do you have to apply it in the same way? That we certainly have a preclusive ruling for purposes of Federal Rule 23. But isn't it pretty much black letter law that if the state enacts verbatim the federal rules of evidence, it's not bound by the Supreme Court's decisions about the meaning of the federal rules of evidence?
Your Honor, that is correct, but I think that we have laid out in the briefing the nature of the rules of the states that have class action. And there are elements of those rules that are in common with the federal rules from an interpretive standpoint in every state. I'm not saying that, for example, that there are a few states out there that don't have manageability requirements. So, in that instance...
Must be California.
or superiority requirements, I meant to say, Your Honor, not manageability. And in those states, I suspect you would say, well, that there's no preclusive effect, it's not a requirement there. But the other elements of the rules do exist in each state, and those core determinations of this court would be overruled by a state court if they went ahead and certified a nationwide class.
Could a state court look at this opinion and then apply, take it into consideration, and obviously a motion to dismiss or whatever, to see how that does comport with the state rule, and then dismiss the case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you're saying could a state court do that?
I mean, wouldn't that be the first order of business, actually?
It may well be, Your Honor, but our view is that there is a need here for the court to protect its ruling on this issue, because the plaintiffs have brought this issue before this court on behalf of a class. The purported class was here, it was fully represented before this court, and a determination was made that it would be an abuse of discretion to certify a class here, and that it would be a violation of the defendant's due process right to proceed with this case on a class basis. There's no reason to ask a state court for a second opinion on that issue. It ought to be something that is protected here. These are the same counsel going before the court basically saying that this court's ruling on that issue should be overruled. And our position is that shouldn't be permitted, that this is a case in which the class certification ruling should be protected. I would note, Your Honors, that going back to a point I was making earlier, that there really can be no serious question that the persons at whom the requested injunction were directed were fully represented in the MDL proceeding on class certification issues. If class certification had been upheld by this court, all of the persons who are now before state courts asking for class certification there would have obtained exactly what they're asking for, asked this court for, and that was treatment of their claims on a class basis. And because they would have so directly benefited from the certification of the class in this proceeding, it denies reality pretend that they were not present or that their interests were not fully represented here. This is truly an instance, Your Honor, where the plaintiffs are not asking for a second bite at the apple. They are asking to eat the entire orchard, to do this over and over and over again until they find some court that will overrule this court's determination that certifying a class here would be an abuse of discretion and a violation of the defendant's due process rights. And class counsel can hardly argue that these folks were not fully represented here because they're involved in so many of those cases. To say that would be to argue that that they are not competent to handle the state proceedings that they have now brought. Now, addressing another point, another element of this that we've touched on previously, plaintiffs assert that this court's class certification ruling cannot be afforded preclusive effect because it's not a final judgment. But again, as I was saying earlier, the rulings of the Seventh Circuit are not that it needs to be a final judgment in the conventional sense. All that's required is that, under the Miller Bruin case, that the decision be immune as a practical matter to reversal or amendment. The court's ruling here didn't leave any room for the district court to certify a class. Plaintiffs have not gone back to the district court and asked for some reconfiguration of a class. And indeed, they told the district court, we're going off to state court because the Seventh Circuit's ruling doesn't leave us an opening here. This is a final ruling. It is entitled to an injunctive relief in this particular instance. I think the equitable considerations here favor the issuance of the requested injunction. The defendant should not be required, indeed the judicial system should not be required to litigate this issue over and over and over again. That's why federal courts are authorized to enjoin state court proceedings that violate that principle and often do. And this principle is particularly compelling given that it came out of an MDL proceeding, a proceeding where cases from all over the country were brought together for the purpose of providing a coordinated ruling. If claimants are simply allowed to walk off to state courts and relitigate issues, particularly class issues, that have been fully and carefully assessed by the MDL proceeding, it would render MDL proceedings and the whole concept worthless. This is what the Eighth Circuit was noting in the Piper aircraft case. And an injunction here is wholly consistent with federalism principles. No state court has a legitimate interest in effectively nullifying this court's final and conclusive class certification determination. As this court noted in the Harper Plastics case, while the Anti-Injunction Act may be grounded in principles of comity and federalism.
You know, you might want to talk about Baker against General Motors for a while.
Your Honor, I don't think Baker versus General Motors is really relevant here. What you had in that case was effectively an agreement between a plaintiff and a defendant that one of the parties in the case wouldn't appear in other proceedings. You basically don't have a privity of interest there is a fundamental problem that you have in that case, and further you have a state court reaching out to issue an injunction against a federal court. It seems to me it's a very different circumstance than what you have here, where it is not a situation where you have a judicial determination where injunctive relief was being sought in order to effectively to enforce that decision. Your Honor, with that, I will reserve time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Mr. Beiser. Mr. Antekaroff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Samuel Zakharoff on behalf of the plaintiffs in the proceeding below, appellees here. Your Honor, I think that the most important issue that this court has to confront is the fact that there is absolutely no authority anywhere in federal case law for the request for the relief sought here. There are
Mr. Zakharoff, could you raise your voice a little bit?
Yes.
Raising your voice probably would help more than raising the microphone. Although
yes.
If you want to raise the podium, there's a little switch on the lower right-hand side.
I'll make do, Your Honor. Thank you. There is no authority for the relief requested here. There are no cases in which a federal court has enjoined state court proceedings on state law, on state procedural issues, such as whether or not to certify a class, unless one of three conditions has been met. Either there has been a final judgment in the federal court system, or there has been a settlement of the merits in the federal court system, or there is a settlement in the works in the federal court system such that the disposition of the matter in dispute can be treated as a race and principles of essentially in rem jurisdiction may attach to that. Except under those three conditions, there are no cases in which a federal court has enjoined a state court from proceeding under its own procedural rules to reach however it wants to handle the merits of a state court proceeding under state law. If this court were to overturn the court below, it would bring this court into direct conflict with the Third Circuit in the GM Trucks case, with the Fifth Circuit in the Clearwater case, and with the Eighth Circuit in the Kennedy case. Mr. Beiser cites Piper. Piper is not the law of the Eighth Circuit at present, so there are no cases that support the request of the relief sought below. And to give an example, among the cases floating around the judicial system around this country, there is at least one case that is a state court action filed before this court's ruling that was never removed. By the requested relief, that would be enjoined, an action that was never in the federal system, in which state court plaintiffs were seeking to avail themselves of state procedure and were seeking simply to enjoy the benefits of how the state courts handle those kinds of claims. In addition, on May 23rd, a letter was directed to this court from Firestone, indicating that Firestone is in the final stages of negotiations for a nationwide resolution of this matter through a state court class action, presumably in Texas. The injunction requested here would enjoin not just a litigation class within a state, but also any type of settlement class. There is simply no authority for that. The reason there is no authority is that this court, in order to overturn the court below, would have to make seven specific moves, each of which is precluded by case law. First of all, the court would have to find that despite the fact that there was no certified class, the absent class members were virtually represented. They were adequately represented, as Mr. Beiser would have it, such that they were effectively here. This court in Tyfe American Airlines expressly rejected that theory of virtual representation, and in the Tyfe case, Judge Diane Wood said specifically that this court has never allowed virtual representation to be the law applied in any reported decision. So this court would have to overturn Tyfe to grant the kind of virtual representation that Mr. Beiser suggests. Second, this court would have to find that in its prior determinations, it was not just warning the district court. It was not just admonishing. It was not just reaching for the issues that were interesting and presented in the case, but it was holding that no state court proceeding, no matter how defined, no matter what the applicable state law...
Look, Ford may have asked for too much, but from your perspective, the hardest claim is demands that state courts certify nationwide classes that would oust not only presumably the cases now pending on an individual basis in federal court, but any other state. Right? Our prior decision clearly holds that the class that was before us had been certified as a nationwide class with adequate representatives was an untenable class. Why isn't that the sort of decision that is binding on all the members of the purported nationwide class?
There's several reasons why it is not binding, Your Honor, and I agree that that is the hardest question. If a state were to try to certify a nationwide class, and I would note that that is not on the agenda.
It's been certified, but at least the appellants say that that has been requested.
In one case in Arkansas, and that has been continued in light of many developments in the case, including the proposed settlement. I think that is the hardest question, Your Honor, and I think that even for that question, this court's ruling should not apply for a variety of reasons. First of all, the general law of preclusion is that it is the task of the second forum, not the first forum, to determine what the preclusive effects of a ruling should be. Second of all, under this court's ruling in cases such as United Rope and Honeywell, there is no personal jurisdiction over the absent class members until such time as they are given notice and the ability to opt out at a due process minimum.
I don't understand that argument. Class members aren't given an opportunity to opt out of the class definition process, right? Whether there is a class covering X is something determined on a class-wide basis and not person by person. It's determined by the court before notice is given, not after notice is given.
That is correct, Your Honor, and this is a minor glitch in the way that Schutz approaches this, but there is no law that allows this court to make a determination on class action status and to essentially export it to persons who...
But you see, that's part of the worry. The argument you're making now and the argument that is obviously being made in state court is our decision counts for nothing. Any state court is free to flip the bird to the Seventh Circuit. No problem. One might think that is exactly what the particular exception to the Anti-Injunction Act is about, is precluding that kind of invitation to a state court.
I think, Judge Easterbrook, that as a policy matter, you may very well be right, that's the way it should be. I think that there are significant constitutional problems, at least the way the Supreme Court has interpreted the reach of federal court power, that get in the way of that. One problem is the personal jurisdiction problem, particularly as defined by this court, in fact, defined by you, Your Honor, as no statute, no suit, that there is no power over the absent parties unless there is a statute underlying the case.
That has to do with claims against the defendants. All the plaintiff class members subjected themselves to the court's jurisdiction.
Well, I think that in Schutz...
We know from Devlin against Scardelletti, there are two cases whose absence from the brief puzzling to me. Syngenta is one, Devlin is the other. Devlin says that missing class members are really parties, which is why they can appeal, according to Devlin, without intervention. Well, if missing class members are really parties, all the potential plaintiffs who submitted themselves to the court's jurisdiction are really parties, and they can be enjoined.
But, Your Honor, in Devlin, a class was certified. Individuals had notice and the opportunity to opt out. It is true that there are different due process standards between plaintiffs and defendants, and that's the ruling in Schutz. But Schutz does not say that there are no due process standards that apply to the absent.
Do you think there would have been any problem with a missing class member after we had said, after we decertified the class? Would there be any problem under Devlin with a missing class member filing a cert petition?
I think the court has not reached that issue, but I think that the court would probably say that that was permissible because they were a party in interest in some sense seeking to get the benefit.
They were a party in interest at least to the extent of making the decision whether a nationwide class could be certified.
Well,
and if they could have sought Supreme Court review to that extent, then they're bound by our decision on the question whether a nationwide class could be certified.
Again, I think that there are strong policy arguments why it should go in that direction, but I think that there are significant constitutional issues that get in the way. And it's not just the personal jurisdiction, Your Honor. I think, going back to Baker versus General Motors, that Baker versus General Motors expresses, at the very least, a strong distaste for exporting procedural rulings across state lines and across jurisdiction. Mr. Beisner's...
Baker is certainly your best friend.
We like Baker. It's not surprising that Ford does not like Baker, given its General Motors pedigree. But I think that Baker is very strong on this question. Baker says that the procedural rules do not accompany the ruling, whether they are evidentiary rules. And I will grant Mr. Beisner that that is under the full faith and credit clause, but that is triggered by the same preclusion doctrines as is the All Writs Act requested relief here.
Of course, there's one problem in Baker that, and indeed one problem in Semtec, which said ordinarily one would look to state law to supply the content of the federal preclusion rule, which is that the consolidated complaint in this case did, after all, have some federal claims in it.
The consolidated complaint had two federal claims in it because it brought in cases from all over. One was a RICO complaint, which was dismissed 6 months before the class certification and which formed no part of the basis, jurisdictional or otherwise, of the class certification. The other is Magnuson Moss, which this court has recognized is essentially parasitic upon state court claims. So the federal interest in this case is astonishingly low. And so in that circumstance, I don't think that the interests of the federal system as a whole are triggered here, Your Honor. I would like to address one point that was raised, which I think is at the heart of Mr. Beisner's argument, which is that effectively you have resolved all these issues for the states because the laws are all the same. They should pay attention to this. I would direct the court's attention to footnote 5 of the Schutz opinion, in which the court is looking around the court system of the entire country trying to figure out whether or not the opt-out rights that it is reading into the Constitution, the requirement for binding absent class members, are present in the laws of all the states. And the Supreme Court, in its perusal of all the state class action laws, finds that only 30 out of the 51 jurisdictions it surveys have the basic right to opt out of a B3 type class action. I raise that only because the idea that this court could take judicial notice that, hey, after all these laws are the same, they would all be applied in the same fashion, is just not supported by either the application of state law class action practice or even by the Supreme Court when it tried to survey class action law. I would also, if I may, add that I'm running out of time. That the question that the court posed regarding the attorneys in this case is another matter that has already been squarely addressed by this court in Tice versus American Airlines. In Tice versus American Airlines, you had a class that was not certified. You had attempts to bring the procedures in other state cases, and a request for relief by this court that the attorneys be barred from participating in subsequent proceedings. This court said that that would be an impermissible interference with the ability of individuals to secure counsel.
The argument that's being made in this case, as I understand it, is that the attorneys made the equivalent of a warranty to the district court, and Ford is now trying to enforce its contract rights. It's that rather than any general principles that need to be discussed.
Well, Your Honor, the warranty to the district court was as follows, that the court hereby approves the voluntary withdrawal of attorneys serving on the Plaintiff's Management Committee from their representation of class actions in state courts. The court expects that the withdrawal will be completed by all affected attorneys as promptly as possible. That's the extent of a warranty. Under normal contract law, that would not give rise to enforceable third-party reliance interests. What's more, the district court, when called upon to ban the attorneys from participating in other cases, specifically found that the condition precedent for that was the maintenance of a single nationwide class action in this case. And the court held that that was the extent of her understanding and that was the extent of the representation to the court. So this court, in order to give the relief that Mr. Beisner requests, would have to find that to be clearly erroneous, would have to find the district court to have been mistaken as to the district court's understanding of what the representation was that was made to her, and bar the lawyers from this kind of proceeding thereafter. I would also note that in the GM Trucks decision, the Third Circuit also addressed this very same issue and came to the same conclusion that this court did in Tice versus American Airlines. Your Honor, there was a question raised by Judge Mannion as to why it is that the state courts can't do this. And the response that was given by Mr. Beisner essentially was that, quote, the judicial system should not be required to be put to this burden. We would submit that this is actually at the heart of this appeal. Whether this court, when sitting in appellate review of an MDL, stands for the entire judicial system. The core argument being made by Ford in this case is that there is a unitary judicial determination, there is a reservoir of federal authority which trumps state autonomy when, quote, the judicial system is called upon to resolve a complicated mass problem such as the one before us here. That authority simply does not exist in a federal system. I think that, again, Baker versus GM is critical on this point. I think that Syngenta, in its recognition of the limitations of all writs act authority as not granting jurisdiction beyond that which Congress has expressly authorized, is critical on this point. But I think at the core, this is a federalism issue. And it is difficult, I understand, for lawyers who have sought to unify everything in one proceeding to come back, but here we are. And we must argue, because
both sides have changed very nicely. The unifiers are now arguing federalism, and Ford, which last time said, leave this to the states, now no longer seems to find the states so friendly.
Well, Ford wanted to leave it to the states so long as they dismissed all the actions. I think that the premise is, from Ford, is that this court's ruling resolves not just the federal questions of an MDL court, and we should be mindful that under Lexicon, that court was not even capable of reaching the merits of this procedure, of this proceeding. So a court without the power to reach the merits all of a sudden is entrusted with the power to resolve all issues.
Wait. It was certainly entitled to reach the merits. The consolidated class complaint was filed in the Southern District of Indiana.
Yes, it was.
And certainly the Southern District of Indiana could resolve that. It couldn't resolve the merits of the cases that were filed elsewhere and transferred in, but it could resolve the consolidated.
It could resolve the consolidated case, but the consolidated case amounts to about 200 individual actions at this point once class certification was denied. That is the extent of the power of the court below, to reach those 200 individuals. There is no jurisdiction, either subject matter jurisdiction or or personal jurisdiction to reach beyond that. And I think my time seems to be...
Still running. You don't have your white light on.
Oh, I can't read these. I apologize, Your Honor. The question then is...
But there's no constitutional obligation to use all your time.
No, and I will not, I don't think. Judge Easterbrook, I think that at bottom, the question in this case is... The difficult issues involve nationwide class certification in state court, and we will grant that. But the relief requested goes to two other aspects of the proceedings below. One is the injunction of a proposed nationwide settlement class that Firestone wishes to enter into. And second, and more significantly, is the requested relief goes primarily to the overwhelming bulk of cases that are pending right now, many of which were on file before this court ever ruled in its initial ruling on class certification. These are cases that involve exclusively state law claims. They are cases that are brought in state court by state residents exclusively, seeking to take advantage of in-state procedures. There is simply no case that they can point to for the authority for a federal court to enjoin that kind of practice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Zakharoff. Mr. Bosner, anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, first of all, the issue of record site that you requested, the commitment that I referenced earlier in the record at A10 through A11, Judge Barker's order referencing those are at A14, footnote 1, and A16 also references the commitment by counsel.
This is your appendix?
Yes,
Your
Honor. Okay. I would also note, Your Honor, that I aired earlier, there is one nationwide class that has been certified. That's the Davison case that is referenced in our brief, and that was a case where the nationwide class was certified ex parte. We were never given an opportunity to participate
what
in that.
What state?
Tennessee, where it happens quite frequently, I must say, Your Honor. A couple of points.
And did the Davidson court discuss our prior opinion?
No, it did not. Your Honor, several points I would note.
Did you copy of Davidson in your appendix?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe the complaint is in there. I'm not sure.
The state court's order is what I would be more interested in.
I believe it is in the appendix, Your Honor.
Okay.
Several things I would note. I think Your Honor is exactly correct in noting that in our earlier appeal to this court, we were concerned about preserving state law and the applicability of the individual state laws and claims. We're not running from that here, Your Honor. We're talking about due process principles and the fact that this court determined on the fact of this case that there was no manageable way consistent with due process to have a trial.
You keep talking about the Constitution, but our opinion does not contain the phrase due process. It doesn't mention the Constitution. It's about Rule 23, not about constitutional limits on what can be done.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that the panel knows its own opinion best, but I'm referring to...
the authors have no priority.
Right.
But if you search for the word Constitution or the phrase due process in that opinion, they aren't there.
I am referring to the last paragraph of the opinion, Your Honor, where I think the court made the point that expediency could not be served here without running afoul of individuals' rights, and that's really what I'm referencing to. I guess it's the penultimate paragraph before the ordering clause there. A couple of other points I'd note, Your Honor. On the Baker case, I'd just like to point out that is an instance of the state court enjoining a federal court. There is no All Writs Act issue in that case. The authority in this case that we're talking about is entirely different because it flows from the All Writs Act. And I would note, for example, in the Winkler case of this circuit, where you had a discovery issue, this court found it perfectly appropriate for the district court to issue an order telling a state court don't pursue a particular discovery issue or further. That is a procedural issue in the case. Those sorts of all writs injunctions are issued all the time. There was also the point made earlier about whether this should be left
to the determination of the state court. Shouldn't the state court decide if this, this court's ruling has a preclusive effect? We talked briefly earlier, there was reference earlier to the Syngenta case, and I would refer the court to footnote 1 in that case, where the court said, yes, it was improper for the district court to remove this case to federal court in order to take control of it. But Justice, Chief Justice Rehnquist said in footnote 1, why didn't you just enjoin the state court from proceeding further with this case, fully recognizing that the sort of relief that we're asking here is entirely appropriate under the All Writs Act? Finally, I would note under the personal jurisdiction category, the view that was expressed earlier on this, that really this is a class action. We're not off into the omni-capital world of cases where we should be talking about service of process on a defendant. This is a class action where the parties are before the court.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.